I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome to Radio Times. Since the 1970s, train travelers arriving or departing from the newly named Gray 30th Street Station in Philadelphia have heard this sound. That's the clickety-clackety sound of the electromechanical flipboard with information for passengers about gates and times. Amtrak has announced that the display is going to be removed and be replaced by a digital sign that they say will be easier to read, cost less to maintain, and better meet the requirements of the Americans with Disabilities Act. The imminent departure for this display sign has created a wave of nostalgia for this board and generated calls to keep it right where it is. Inga Safran, the Pulitzer Prize-winning architecture critic for the Philadelphia Inquirer, made such an argument last week and joins us on Radio Times. Inga, nice to have you back with us.
Nice to be here, Marty.
Nice to have you with us. While the 30th Street Station sign was made by an Italian firm, there's a local company that also makes flipboards, Oat Foundry, and joining us is Mark Kuhn. He's the founder and CEO. And Mark, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Long time, first time. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Nice to have you with us. And I should say that we posted this show on our Facebook page and things exploded. So let me give out that phone number. It's 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. Let me play that flipboard sound once again, and then we will begin our conversation. Let's give it a listen. All right, Inga, I'm a sound person because I'm on the radio. Right. What is it about that sound?
Well, as I wrote, the clickety-clack, as you walk into the station, you know, people are just drawn to the screen because, of course, you want to know if your train is late or on time and what track. And it's like this public hearth, and then you hear this sound, which very much echoes the sound of the clickety clack of the trains on the track. And you feel like you're going somewhere. Maybe you're going on vacation. Maybe you're going to see a relative, and it just puts you in the mood for travel. It's just a very evocative sound.
Is that the reason to keep it?
Well, I understand that Amtrak has a lot of functional needs and the world changes, and they're not unreasonable to want to satisfy those needs, but the technology exists to have the best of both worlds. You can have a new version or improved version of this sign that is totally tied into the cloud, that meets their needs for public address systems, that is much more updatable. So why not have both?
Let me get you in on the conversation, Mark. And
sure.
What's so interesting is that this was something actually goes back 100 years, but at 30th Street Station goes back to the 1970s. Are flipboards making a comeback in 2018, 2019?
I should say in a way that we maybe didn't anticipate. Oat Foundry started this project. I can give you a little of our backstory for it. So we started as a company 5 years ago, engineering design company, building all kinds of cool stuff for local businesses. Jen and Justin from Honeygrow were in 30th Street traveling to some new scouting location, saw that sign and said, how do we get that for us?
And as a menu board,
as a menu, as a way to call out order numbers in their restaurants. They came to Oat Foundry and said, can you build this, but can you do it in an updated, cool, keep the sound, keep the look, but it has to be cloud controlled. It has to be reliable because that's a huge issue with the one at 30th Street. So how do we, can we do that in a totally updated, cool way? And we were like, of course, absolutely. We did the whole project for Honeygrow, built 20 signs, did a pilot program, and then at the end they said, you know what, this is a cool thing. We're a healthy local company making food. You guys should take this and turn it into a product.
Wow.
And we were, thank you very much. We fell in love with it, and we put it out there, and the world started doing some marketing for it, and the first order was for the Chicago Cubs for a bar.
For a bar for the Chicago Cubs. Interesting. We played that sound from 30th Street Station, and I should say you brought in some things for show
some
and
toys.
Tell. They don't
Absolutely.
Always work on the radio, but let's hear that flip
so I have,
sound that you have there.
I have one module here, and let me see if we can get this to sound something
okay.
Like
that. There you go.
Yeah, so there's a little bit of a metallic sound you can kind of hear when they're outside of their casings.
Right.
But when you have a whole wall of them clacking away, it is this romantic sound. You know, to answer, I think to answer part of your question about why it's so alluring, I think part of that is that travel is, when they first came out in the 50s, travel's alluring.
Sure.
There's something romantic about it. And when you have this moment of anticipation before finding out where you're going and how you're getting there, what track you're going to be on, there's something about that that is like the anticipation, I think, is romantic.
Inga, are you surprised at the amount of interest this move? And it's been in the works for a couple of years, we should say. It just seems as if it's imminent as opposed to a couple of years away. Are you surprised at the response here in Philadelphia?
Well, no, not really, because 2 years ago when Amtrak first announced it, there was a big hue and cry about it. And then, you know, these things take so long, people have other things on their minds, they forget. But when it was, you know, when they announced that it was really, really happening, you know, people were really, really upset. And, you know, it's not scientific, but, you know, I judged the number of tweets and retweets. And
this is how we do things now.
Right? I'm not too proud to say. I look at the numbers. And they're incredible, you know. There is a real heartfelt feeling about this sign. And I was in 30th Street Station the other day, and people from Amtrak were saying, who work for Amtrak were saying, I love this sign. It's really sad to see it go.
Well, and I should say that we had a representative from Amtrak booked to join us this hour. They unbooked themselves last night. They were unable to join the conversation. I had a lot of questions for them, but I'll just toss to you, Inga, their concerns. First of all, that this is an old board, and apparently they used parts in order to keep it going. There have been problems in the past where it wasn't working, and we need to make sure that people get correct information. The digital world sort of controls the rest of the world that we're in. Why hold out for something like this?
So, you know, sure, I'm totally sympathetic to Amtrak's desire to improve its infrastructure and to have more reliable information. And all transit systems want real-time information. I think where they've gone wrong in a couple of ways, I mean, the whole world is besotted by screens. And if you go to 30th Street Station, there are a lot of screens there already, some of them doing very little, telling you very little. There's a huge screen, you know, that over and over again repeats, if you see something, say something. Mm-hmm. You know, is a digital screen, which uses, you know, a fair amount of energy, the best way to communicate these things? We're in this period where we just see screens as the solution to everything. So I think that's one issue. And I think the other issue about the sign, although it's not original to the station, which
right.
was designed in the 20s by the successor firm to Daniel Burnham of Chicago, mm-hmm. It's not original, but it is part of Amtrak's origin story. Amtrak was not formed until 1971. It rose out of the ashes of all these failed private railroads like the Pennsylvania Railroad and the Reading Railroad. You know, it came into being in 71. You know, it was done kind of cynically. A lot of people in Washington didn't think, you know, this is going to go anywhere. People aren't going to take trains anymore. But, you know, they pushed on, and they inherited, as one person from Amtrak told me, all this junk, all this junk from all these failed private railroads that hadn't made any investments. They hadn't invested in their stations, and Amtrak very slowly began to make improvements. And this board is one of the improvements. And it was the technology of the time. But, you know, we respect the technology of the building itself. Why not respect the technology of this board as a piece of history?
Well, Mark, let me go back to you. And,
sure.
And can you then make a flipboard that gives more than just gate and time? I mean, can you create this kind of technology that gives the kind of information that would, for instance, meet the requirements of the Americans with Disabilities?
Yeah, absolutely. And as I understand the ADA compliance, it's typically determined based on the use of the of wherever the signage is. So in an office, you have different requirements than if you're doing wayfinding or exit signage or in an airport or in this case a train station. Because split flaps, the ones that we make, are frequently ADA compliant for wherever they're going, for the bars and restaurants, for the office buildings that they're going. And it's contingent on the height of the letters, The conspicuity and the legibility of the font. So sans serif is the font that you have to use.
Oh, sans serif. Oh,
yeah,
really?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
And there's a lot of, you know, fonts in that family, but that is what you have to use.
Because it's the most visually, visibly understandable?
I think that's probably, yeah, probably the least flourish to it, which is there's plenty of cool sans serif fonts out there.
Yeah.
We actually had to design our own font for this one, which is a whole other thing, but we're happy to do it. The spacing between the letters. And then, so the height of the letters, I think, is the biggest one for 30th Street, is that the size, and the ones on our signs right now, the ones we produce, are a little bit larger than the ones at 30th Street.
Mm-hmm.
We've also done, like, 1 foot high signs before, like
flipboard
modules. Yeah, right. We call it picture flap. But so to do something for them that's ADA compliant would not be difficult. It would be paired with a PA system regardless.
Well, I was going to say, what about people who are hearing impaired?
Yeah, so so regardless of – it's actually because it's flapping, you have that audible component to information changing. So that's really, really attractive about split flaps from the 50s, you know, when they were first starting to come out, is that you had this moment of clack, 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 clack. I know information's coming. But to pair it with a modern-day PA system, that's not difficult at all.
Let me quote something. This goes back to 2016. Inga, this is when I guess this idea first came out. This is Mike Tolbert of Amtrak talking about the Solari board that's at 30th Street Station, apparently run by Windows 95. The Philly board probably has printed circuits that were developed in the 1960s, basically saying, I mean, this is old technology. You wouldn't want to go to a hospital and have something, you know, have surgery run by Windows 95.
I don't think anyone's saying keep this particular flipboard. You know, there's this expression, the same axe twice in historic preservation. You know, somebody has some farmer has an axe, you know, he uses it, he changes the handle, he continues to use it, he changes the blade, but he says it's the same axe twice. And I think
ship a thesis. I think, yeah.
Is that called evolution or
you
upgrade?
Know, I think the more I think the point is the more important thing is this is a thing that is used and loved, and it doesn't matter if the parts are replaced or if the box is replaced or if an updated version is put in. It's the same board twice, and people like this form. This design.
We're almost having a break here. Inga, have you talked to Amtrak? I mean, made your case directly to Amtrak?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I interviewed a couple people from Amtrak. And, I mean, they were public information people.
Right.
So, you know, they were just conveying information to me.
Right.
But, you know, they told me that they want to satisfy ADA requirements. That's perfectly reasonable. They want better function. It is hard to find parts. I did interview the people from Solari USA, which was the original manufacturer of this board, and they could refurbish it for $100,000.
I've read that. Let's take a very short break, and we'll get back to our conversation. That's Inga Saffron. She's architecture critic for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Also with us, Mark Kuhn, founder and CEO of Haute Foundry. That's a locally based company that manufactures split-flap display boards. We're talking about the one at 30th Street Station. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, and in this hour of Radio Times, we are talking about the iconic flipboard at 30th Street Station. Amtrak says it wants to replace it with a digital display board that they believe will give more correct information and be ADA compliant. And I do have this statement from Amtrak. The new digital and state-of-the-art PIDS board that will take its place allows us to have a more modern and tech-friendly station with an ADA compliant display board. And again, we had hoped to talk directly with someone from Amtrak. They were unable to do that, but hopefully we'll be talking with Congressman Brendan Boyle in about 10 minutes or so. In the meantime, we want to hear from you, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me read some comments here. One from Tom. What happens to the old flipboard to a museum, maybe the Franklin Institute? Inga, my understanding is that there's a railroad museum in the middle of Pennsylvania, and that's where they are planning planning on
putting it. That has been reported that in Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania, the board will go to them.
And there's a big – I've been there. It's a big railroad museum there.
That's good.
Yeah, it's a very cool place, actually. A question for Michael. How much has Amtrak been spending each year to maintain the Flipboard? Again, we don't have a representative from Amtrak. Mark, you just gave me some kind of a high sign there.
I don't know. I have – I think zero. I think nothing. And I think that they've reported that you can repair it. But we were in there for a marriage proposal with like a rental sign, and they had asked us to fix their Solari board. I was like, oh, no, I mean, we're not gonna, we won't fix yours. We'll replace it if you want, but we're not going to fix it.
Are we seeing these Flipboards, though? I mean, you mentioned Honeygrow here in Philadelphia, but I'm wondering about other places in other parts of the world. Are they making a comeback?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Response from just people finding us on like the fourth page of Google before we did any kind of marketing was enormous. And now we have, you know, great marketing team. But we have signs all over the world. We have them in Hong Kong, UK.
And these are flip signs.
Oat Foundry, Split Flap. Yeah, flip flaps. Yeah. We even have one at Shakespeare and Company bookstore in Center City, which says what kind of books are printing on their local book printing machine. And a couple other local Philly businesses are getting them too early next year. So we're pretty excited to share them. But yeah, we have them kind of, we have hundreds out there now. I mean, they're everywhere.
Let me read an email from Thomas who said, will they record and play the sound when the board is updated with a new digital one? The beauty of the clickety-clack draws one's attention to the sign against the backdrop of other electronic beeps. I wonder if I could toss that to you, Inga, about, and I've seen this question being asked saying, okay, go digital, but, you know, have that nice clickety-clackety sound. Do you think that's an option?
It's an option. When I was doing my research on this, I found some pictures of the digital screen in Penn Station, New York, and the one in Newark Penn Station. The digital screen in New York is just awful. The color,
what's your definition of awful?
The color, the blueness of the screen background, the light, the display. It's just so dreary and depressing and undesigned. And they did a way better job in Newark where they designed the screen to look a little bit like a flipboard. Huh. And apparently – I haven't been there, but apparently it mimics the sound. So at least visually, that's a better experience.
And would you be comfortable with that? I mean, something that was.
I'd rather have the real thing. I'd rather have the real thing. Just one other thing I want to say about these flipboards is, as we become more inundated with digital screens, we really crave analog things, you know. And there's a long list of these analog things because they have sound, they have texture, they have life. And I think
authenticity.
I think this is just another case of like, let me see and look at something that seems like it's been touched by the human hand.
Well, and I've always wanted to bring back the dial tone. I really miss that sound of it. It looks like you wanted to say something.
Yeah, about why they have had this incredible resurgence. And we think part of it is because we know when you look at this, when you look at these split flap signs, you know they're real. You know that there's a motor in there turning something, that there's some gears or belts or something clacking away. And it might be a little bit beyond the realm of what you understand mechanically, but it's not so far beyond it like a TV. Like many people have no idea how a TV works. Sure. It's just this magic white box, right? Or silver box. For these, there's that, it's just beyond the realm of comprehension that you can feel it and you can hear it and you know it's real. And that's what makes it so important.
Can you give us a minute description, though, of how it works? I mean, in a
sure,
way
yeah.
that us lay folks can understand.
I have some brilliant, a brilliant team, so some frequently I don't understand it. But the split flaps that we made, we started from the ground up. We completely, blew apart the old design, and we said we're going to completely reinvent this. So it's a sheet metal housing, powder-coated sheet metal. On that are there's a stepper motor inside, and on top of the stepper motor is a carousel that has the flaps. Right. There's 50 flaps on an Oat Foundry split flap, which is alphanumeric punctuation, some special characters. And then the motor themselves, we had to do a lot of work on how to make sure that it's showing the right flap. So when we designed our own boards for it, we put a little sensor in there that every time the carousel goes around, it notifies that sensor, I'm at A, I'm at A, I'm at A. And so if it's not at A, it'll keep flapping until it gets there.
Huh.
And then it can recalibrate itself. We've had a sign going in our shop for something like 10 million rotations. A torture sign, which is like 40 years
of use. A torture sign, which is push it to its farthest limit?
It's in a dusty, I mean, it's a machine shop, right? Mm-hmm. So it's an manufacturing facility, and it's just grinding away, you know, no failures if there are 10 million rotations is crazy.
So you've got the mechanical part, and then obviously the computer part, right?
Software was a big part of it. Yeah, when we looked at this, we said four Windows 95 computers and punch cards isn't really going to fly. It was 2015 when we first brought these back. So let's make it so that you can hit a button on a cell phone and send a message immediately. And so when we built this, there's a whole kind of back-end software of how to get motors to turn flaps. And then there's the front-end stuff, which is it hooks into a network, which is a standard Ethernet cable. You navigate to the sign on the network. The control system lives on the sign, and it has screens. What you see is what you get. You know, you would like the skeuomorphism of it. You type it in on the screen, and you hit send, and it goes clack, clack, clack immediately. You know, no delay. Wow. You can schedule messages. You can add animations. You can go. We have what we call classic is one of the animations where it goes clack, 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 line by line, much like the Solari boards. So that was one we actually had to program in, because if they're all going at once, it almost sounds like a beautiful rainstorm, but not that line-by-line kind of lockstep, you know, clacking.
It's interesting that the subtleties of sound, how significant that they are. Let me read some more comments. One from Nick. Every time I pass through 30th Street Station, I mourn the imminent disappearance of the flipboard, and I'm happy when I hear the clack of the old one still in place. It should stay. It's the heart of 30th Street Station. Inga, my understanding is, and you mentioned New York, that Philly is, if not the last, one of the last stations that's still, big stations, I guess, that still has this flipboard.
In the U.S., this is what the Amtrak spokesperson told me, that this is the last station that they've gotten around to changing. I was told by Solari's president that some of these continue to exist in Europe. He mentioned Milan, which is a huge station, way busier.
And they have a flipboard?
And they apparently have a flipboard. You may know that they're renovating Saarinen's very famous TWA terminal at Kennedy Airport, the one that looks like a bird. Well, it's becoming a hotel, but they are keeping the original Solari board, which is in a very cool housing that mimics the building itself with wings. I don't think the technology has outlived its usefulness.
Let me just quickly reintroduce the two of you. That's Inga Safran. She's architecture critic for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Mark Kuhn is founder and CEO of Oat Foundry, and that's a locally based company that manufactures split flap display boards. And joining us now is Congressman Brendan Boyle. He represents Pennsylvania's 13th district, and I was checking my Twitter feed last night, and I saw that he was going to talk to Amtrak about the 30th Street Station flipboard. And Congressman Boyle, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
All right, thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Did you speak to Amtrak last night?
I did. I talked to Amtrak CEO Richard Anderson for quite some time about this and one other issue that related to jobs in my district, since we have one of the largest Amtrak call centers anywhere in the country is located in my district in Northeast Philadelphia. But the first thing that I raised with him, and actually the thing that we talked about in much greater detail at greater length, was this sign.
Yep.
And I expressed to him that as a Philadelphian, one of the things that I'm most proud about is the beauty of 30th Street Station. It has been shown in dozens and dozens of films, contrasted to New York's Penn Station, which is an ugly mess. Our 30th Street Station is really, I think, one of the most beautiful, if not the most beautiful in the country. And I said to him, I think an important part of that, really the centerpiece, and that people, myself included, have a certain attachment to, is this clickety-clack sign, that it evokes something about rail that any other mode of transportation, it seems to me, just doesn't have.
Well, I'm curious about what the CEO of Amtrak then said back to you. You made this eloquent argument. What was the response?
Well, I'm glad you think it was eloquent. Hopefully it's effective. because I was quite encouraged with his response. because I was frankly dug in for a harder conversation. He thought that, first he agreed with me on 30th Street Station. He said it's actually one of the things they're proudest of at Amtrak, so it's not just a Philadelphia perspective. He also said, contrary to what has been out there, that this was a done deal, that in fact it wasn't a done deal. That he thought there was some way that this is all part of their wanting to upgrade, and in his words, do a better job at addressing their number one complaint they get from customers from their surveys, and that is the lack of real-time data to passengers on either station gate changes or typically trains being delayed. As part of that, that's what changing the sign was about. He thought there's a way they could still achieve that goal and keep the sign.
We're trying to figure out where to go with this, and I'm looking at Inga, who's salivating over here. But yeah,
so
go ahead.
That was as of about 6 o'clock yesterday evening when I was talking to him from a phone in my office. I'm to follow up with him, and I would point this out. This wasn't just one flippant comment he made. About three different times, he said that he was optimistic that they would be able to preserve the sign there and to, you know, relook at this and figure out a way that they can keep the sign while at the same time still achieving their goal of an upgrade. He also told me, by the way, that this wasn't, because I made the point to him that if you're just looking at this from a cost-benefit analysis, that you should keep in mind all the goodwill you're going to lose by removing the sign, that there are a lot of people who support rail because of the beauty of 30th Street Station, because of the history with it, and that you lose something. He responded that actually this whole upgrade is incredibly expensive for them and that they're not doing it to save money. In fact, quite the opposite, that this is costing them a good bit of money. So I come away, well, I'm certainly going to continue to follow up on this because it's personally important to me and important to our city. And he knows that we're going to be following up again in a few weeks right after the holidays come January. He mentioned an RFP that was going out in January and looking at that to change it, to figure out a way that the sign can be preserved. But I come away from the conversation encouraged that we can save this.
Hold on, because I want to give our guests a chance to respond, and I have some more comments I want to read as well. I'm looking at you, Inga Saffron. Does that give you hope?
Yes, absolutely. That's very encouraging. And if the RFP is not written, there's lots of opportunity. RFP is the request for proposals to suppliers. So, you know, it's very crucial, the language that's used in those requests, that they're broad enough to accommodate different suppliers. So if they haven't written that, that's great. Then there's plenty of time.
What do you think, Mark?
I think that's very encouraging. And I think that the issue with real-time data, no problem. Ode Foundry's built signs that have pulled flight tracker data and put it on the board, have pulled sports scores and put it on the board. And I think if you're going to focus on jobs, I mean, we're expanding our shop from Ben Salem back into Philadelphia, into the Frankfurt Arsenal, and we're adding jobs. So that's local. I mean, it doesn't get better than that, I think.
Let me read some more comments. An email from Rochelle. So sad that 30th Street Station info is going to go digital. More digital screens to give us more eye strain. An email from Patricia. I'm still hopeful that the flipboard at 30th Street Station will be saved. Please, Inga, keep pushing. A Facebook comment from Samira. Just make the digital sound make the noise. I think you all are making this much more complicated than it needs to be. A tweet from Robert. To hear the clicks of times and destinations on the 30th Street flipboard is to hear the future. When we hear it, we're touched by where we could have gone, by where we are going. Some poetry there. I wonder to you, Congressman Boyle, as you said, this was one of several things that you wanted to talk to Amtrak about, but are you willing to go to the mat for the flipboard at 30th Street Station?
Well, I would say define. I should be careful and say define go to the mat, but the easy
put
answer
your,
is
put your whole career on the line.
that's quite something. But I would say yes. I mean, the short answer. And this might be a little hard to describe, you know, to someone who might think, well, this is just a sign. You know, what's the big deal about? But the beauty of 30th Street Station, it's iconic, and I do think that if you take away that sign, which kind of, I mean, even the sound of it evokes back to an earlier time.
Right.
If you lose that, you are losing an important part of the station. And I did remind, and was, you know, pretty shameless about reminding the CEO about my strong support for Amtrak and a big believer in Amtrak funding, which I am. I believe we've chronically underfunded high-speed rail in this country, especially compared to Asia and to Europe. And so if Philadelphia is going to be the keystone of the Northeast Corridor, which we are, and we have this wonderful asset, why would we stupidly allow this sign that means so much to so many people, why would we allow it to be scrapped? It just doesn't make any sense whatsoever. And again, I was actually expecting a more difficult conversation with the CEO because he was very sympathetic to what I was saying, and he thought, and he mentioned it three times, that it could be saved.
Well, and we have about a minute before we have to say goodbye to all three of you. Inga, I want to just give you a chance to respond.
You know, I think it would be really exciting. I think Amtrak would get a lot of goodwill, and they could really capitalize on this. They need all the supporters they can get. I think they'll get them.
And 30th Street Station, I mean, it is a beautiful station. And just even the sound beyond the flipboard is so wonderful.
You know, the feeling of coming home and walking up the steps from the platform into the waiting room, it's just a glorious feeling. Mm. And, you know, I feel very grateful to live in a city with a real train station.
Well, and Mark, flipboards look like what's old becomes new again, right?
Oat Foundry is an engineering design company. We're growing in the Philadelphia area. We've been here for 5 years, and we're going to be here for the long haul. We make the exact product that Amtrak wants, and it sounds like their CEO wants it. So I encourage him to give me a call.
Well, on that note, my thanks to all three of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Congressman Boyle, thanks so much.
All right. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Mark Kuhn, thank you for coming in.
Thanks very much,
Founder and CEO of Oat Foundry. And Inga Saffron, always a pleasure. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. Architecture critic for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Shifting gears, as we often do, we'll be talking with Washington investigative correspondent for the New York Times, Mark Mazzetti, about Jared Kushner and Saudi Arabia after this short break. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. The president's son-in-law and White House senior advisor Jared Kushner had private conversations with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman after the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi at the Turkish embassy. That's what the New York Times reported this week, an investigation into the close relationship between these two powerful 30-somethings. The CIA has concluded that the Crown Prince ordered the killing of Khashoggi, who was working for the Washington Post. According to the Times, Saudi leaders began their, quote, courtship of Kushner when Trump was elected president. We asked Mark Mazzetti, one of the authors of this report, to join us on Radio Times and tell us more. He is Washington correspondent for the New York Times. Mark Mazzetti, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good to be back. Thanks.
Why, Jared, of all the people that the Saudi leaders could curry favor with, why Jared?
What we report on is this sort of two-year effort by the Saudis to get into the Trump inner circle. And they identified Jared Kushner early on, really immediately after the election of 2016, as someone who potentially could be a person they could work with. For one thing, he was influential within the Trump inner circle as the president's son-in-law. He also had this very strong commitment to the Middle East, issues in the Middle East, this idea of trying to bring about Middle East peace. And the Saudis saw Kushner as someone who allied with their own interests. And I'll be more specific. The Saudis actually gradually over time have seen Israel as, I won't say an ally, but as a country that is more in line with their interests than not, in particular, realigning the Middle East against Iran. And so what they saw in Kushner is someone with close ties to Israel and who might be able to push policies in the Trump administration that overall could be more hawkish towards Iran.
And I want to pick up on that, but you also write about his inexperience. I mean, did they see someone within the White House with obviously close associations with president-elect and then President Trump someone that they could manipulate?
That was certainly a concern among some American officials early on, and some documents that we reported in our story on Sunday showed how the Saudis certainly saw, we don't use the word manipulation, but certainly someone they saw as inexperienced, someone who they could maybe help shape the views of about this region. And so that was something that they became committed to pretty early on in the process.
Well, we know I believe it was the first trip that the president took was to Saudi Arabia, and then much was made about arms sales. Mark, what can you tell us, I guess, about what was promoted and what was the reality when it came to arms sales, U.S. arms sales or weapons sales to Saudi Arabia?
This is one of the puzzling things over the last couple of years is why the Trump administration, so early in the administration, comes out of the gate so for Saudi Arabia and so committed to this relationship. As you say, the first trip President Trump took overseas was to Riyadh for the summit, and there was a lot of lead into that. One of the things was a lot of arms sales that were promised to the Saudis. Jared Kushner, we reported, and others reported, was intimately involved in helping broker those arms sales. There was also a several billion dollar infrastructure fund that was promised by the Saudis, infrastructure for the United States. So there were a lot of promises, but as is often the case with the U.S.-Saudi relationship, the promises are always are not often lived up to. There's usually promises of big deals, whether it's arms or other things, but people will tell you, in fact, the reality of the actual purchases is far less significant than the promises. But certainly, during that first period of time in the early months of the administration, there was a lot of discussion with the Saudis, a lot of promises, and, you know, that's piqued some interest of people, not just Washington politicians, but also the Mueller investigation, which has been, we've reported, interviewing people who were present for some of those talks to inquire, you know, what was going on behind the scenes before the Riyadh summit and some of these deals that were being put into place.
And again, that's Mark Mazzetti. He is a Washington-based investigative correspondent for The New York Times and one of the authors of a pretty comprehensive report on Sunday in The Times looking at the relationship between Jared Kushner and Saudi Arabia, and in particular his relationship with the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. You can join us 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Mark, what's at the root then of this relationship between Jared and Mohammed? They do apparently use each other's first name. You quote someone in your article talking about this bromance. What is this relationship about?
I think it's complicated. You know, on one level, it's possible these two young, influential people saw themselves as kindred spirits. They were people who were a new generation who had a great deal of influence and power at a young age. Now, we should point out that at the beginning of the Trump administration, Mohammed bin Salman was, in fact, the third in line to power in Saudi Arabia. He was actually just the defense minister and the deputy crown prince. But early on, the White House wooed him as almost as if he were king. He was brought to Washington and given really a treatment that's usually reserved for heads of state. And we report that a lot of that was Jared Kushner pushing that. He saw Mohammed bin Salman as someone who the United States should really try to get behind. And again, he wasn't even the next in line for the throne. It would be several months before he really very quickly pushed aside his cousin, who was the crown prince, and consolidated power. There's been a lot of questions about whether the U.S. and Jared Kushner in particular was sort of quietly giving its blessing to that consolidation of power, and that's still unclear. But there are a lot of different layers to the relationship. And another is, it should be said that Mohammed bin Salman at this time was also sort of pushing this reform agenda, making himself out as someone who is different than previous Saudi leaders, someone who would you know, bring entertainment, movies to Saudi Arabia, let women drive. He went, remember, to to the United States. He met with Mark Zuckerberg, the head of Facebook. So he was trying to sort of show himself as a new face of Saudi Arabia.
But is he? I mean, yes, on the one hand, there were these more, I guess, reformist or even moderate things that he did. But nonetheless, there is a very ruthless side of him. And the CIA has concluded that he essentially ordered the murder of Khashoggi.
Absolutely. So this has been the facade to some degree versus the reality. Now, what have we seen over the last year? You've seen him, Mohammed bin Salman, who is now the crown prince, the next in line to the throne, and you know, for all intents and purposes, the real, I would say, leader of Saudi Arabia right now. He has had a ruthless crackdown inside the kingdom against his opponents under the guise of a anti-corruption crackdown. You'll recall that he jailed dozens and hundreds of other royals in the Four Seasons in Riyadh, or sorry, the Ritz-Carlton in Riyadh, and ordered some very brutal interrogations. Then, a couple months ago, we saw the brutal killing of Jamal Khashoggi, who, as you said, the CIA has determined was killed on the orders of Mohammed bin Salman. So this is, we're seeing the dark and ruthless side of Mohammed bin Salman coming out in the last year.
Let me play a clip. This goes back a couple of years, but I don't believe that President Trump has contradicted what he said. This is the president speaking to reporters. It's November 20th, and he's defending his decision not to cut ties and not to punish bin Salman for the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi.
Maybe he did. Maybe he didn't. They did not make that assessment. The CIA has looked at it. They've studied it a lot. They have nothing definitive. And the fact is, maybe he did, maybe he didn't. If you look at Iran, what they've done, they've been a bad actor. You look at what's happening in Syria with Assad, with hundreds of thousands of people killed. We are with Saudi Arabia. We're staying with Saudi Arabia. And by the way, just so everybody, I have no business whatsoever with Saudi Arabia. Couldn't care less.
Mark, we need to correct that. The intelligence agency, CIA in particular, have found or determined that Mohammed bin Salman did order the killing of Khashoggi.
Yes, and our best understanding of that CIA assessment is that there isn't one hard piece of damning evidence that shows exactly that he gave the order, that there was no, quote, smoking gun in the sense of an intercept, et cetera, of him giving the order. However, it is a very confident assessment of the CIA that he did actually order the killing of Khashoggi. To President Trump's statement, which was then followed up by really an extraordinary press release that the president put out, talking about basically how America first, the Saudi Arabia provides you know, jobs, money for the United States. So we really can't hold them to any kind of a standard of behavior because basically everyone does this kind of stuff. It was extraordinary for an American president to put that kind of statement out. And he really sort of boiled down the sort of Trump doctrine, which is there are no values in American foreign policy. Basically, American foreign policy is transactional. Who we decide to be friends or enemies with is based on not American values, but this idea of who gives us what, who offers what, and who buys what from the United States. It's also, just quickly,
sure,
one important point to make is that statement is really put the United States and put the Saudi-U.S. relationship even more directly tied to the U.S.-Mohammed bin Salman relationship. Basically, he's saying the American relationship with the with Saudi Arabia is, in fact, the same as our relationship with MBS, as opposed to distancing the man from the country and saying, yes, the United States has interest in Saudi Arabia, but we also have interest in not being too close with someone who, as you said, the CIA determined had killed a journalist quite brutally.
In fact, in your story, you say that Jared Kushner was giving advice to bin Salman about how to weather the storm.
Yes, one of the things we reported was that these exchanges, and we believe some kind of text message exchanges between Jared Kushner and Mohammed bin Salman, have continued since Khashoggi's killing. And one of the things that Kushner has offered is some advice on what Mohammed bin Salman should be doing in the wake of this. Settle some of his disputes in the region, settle some of his disputes within the kingdom, don't make these kinds of mistakes again. And we also believe that Jared Kushner has internally inside the White House been making this argument that, hey, the United States-Saudi relationship is bigger than the killing of Jamal Khashoggi. Let us not forget that, and let us not overreact to this episode, and keep in mind the big picture, which is not just the U.S.-Saudi relationship, but its impact on the region. So this is where Kushner has played a very influential role since Khashoggi's killing.
And it's Kushner and bin Salman together, what, by themselves? And I'm curious, what is the response of the State Department? What is the response of the CIA or even the Defense Department to these private meetings?
Well, there was certainly concern, as we reported early on, when there seemed to be unsupervised calls and exchanges between MBS and Kushner. There was some effort to kind of institute more rules about those communications so that the rest of the American government knows what's going on when a senior White House advisor is communicating with the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. There certainly is concern at the CIA. There's certainly concern at the State Department about kind of informal statecraft and how, you know, foreign policy is being conducted outside of normal channels. Now, this wouldn't be the first time this has ever happened, but, you know, when we're talking about a key American ally, we're talking about a very sensitive moment in the relationship after the Khashoggi killing, there is concern that there is sort of back-channel discussions going on that may be contrary to ultimately what the United States' interests are in Saudi Arabia.
Do we know what Kushner has said about the war in Yemen, what he has said to bin Salman, for instance?
Well, we know and have reported that, Kushner has, broadly supported the Saudi campaign in Yemen, and he has not, to the point of saying the Saudis should do whatever they want and the United States should not criticize them, but he has, again, seen the war in Yemen as one aspect of where the United States can support Saudi Arabia, support Mohammed bin Salman, keep this crucial relationship going forward. Again, not to overstate it, but it's important to see he sees this sort of remaking of the Middle East where the United States and the Saudis can work with Iran, work with the United Arab Emirates, work with Egypt in a way realigning the region against Iran, which many see, certainly that group see as the primary threat.
So Iran is the, what, number one enemy in the Middle East for the United States, according to the Trump administration?
Certainly. And it's certainly the number one enemy, not only of Israel, but of Saudi Arabia, of the UAE. And I think this is a generational thing as well, whereas the older generation of Saudis saw the Israel-Palestine issue as the sort of number one issue. And as long as the United States was supporting Israel, it was hard to get too close because the Saudis saw themselves as the sort of protector of the Palestinians. I think a younger generation sees things differently. They're less wedded to the Palestinian cause. That's certainly true of Mohammed bin Salman. And they see Iran as the great future threat. And those who might help Saudi Arabia align itself and defend itself against Iran can be potential allies. And that's where we even see a little bit of a thawing of relations between the Israelis and the Saudis.
Fascinating stuff. Mark Mazzetti, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Washington investigative correspondent for The New York Times. And again, talking about a report he had with some other Times journalists in the Sunday edition of The Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Also, if you join our group page on Facebook, you'll get a little demonstration about how flipboards work. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us.